This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. He's a straight-talking Midwesterner who's as comfortable commanding the most powerful military on the planet as he is trading pithy one-liners with the Washington Press Corps. This hour, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, superpower celebrity. First, a look at new ups and downs in the business world. In the same day that the country's second-largest discount retailer filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, the world's largest internet retailer announced its first-ever profits. I talked to James Sirwicki earlier today. He writes on business for The New Yorker. I asked him if the success of Amazon.com and failure of Kmart suggest the triumph of the new economy that they might have a few years ago.
I think what it really says is very company-specific. I think it says that Kmart really basically had to pay the piper. And I think in the case of Amazon, you are talking about a company that in a lot of ways has delivered on the promises that it made. It certainly didn't deliver on the promises that people thought it was making back when Amazon was worth, you know, $12 billion. But I think it's a company that actually is really starting to become what a lot of us had imagined it would be.
Let's talk about Kmart first. Newsweek's lead sentence this week says, quotes a consumer saying Kmart stores are yucky. What's the piper that Kmart is paying?
Well, I think they just really missed the boat. They missed the boat both in terms of, say, operations, in terms of just the way they run their stores. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in a Kmart recently, but for the longest time now, you know, their shelves have been bare. They do a very bad job of stocking goods. And you compare them to a company, obviously, like Walmart, and the differences are just so striking in terms of the way Walmart runs its business. And on the other side, if you look at a company like Target, which has carved out a very clear and coherent identity for itself as kind of the cool, low-price retailer.
Right, it's nifty.
Right, exactly. You know, Kmart has nothing except for Martha Stewart, which it has done a very good job of signing up Martha Stewart and selling her goods. But in every other way, Kmart has kind of let its investors and I think its customers down.
James Sirwicki, what happens with a company like Kmart that allows it to go to seed, allows it to go dowdy when all these fresh new ideas are blossoming around it? Why does that happen?
I don't know. It's actually a fascinating question because, you know, Kmart about, say, 30 years ago, Kmart was really the kind of new force in retailing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was sort of, in a way, beginning to eclipse Sears. And I think a lot of people had very high expectations for it. I tend to think, in part, what happened is just that it's very easy, ironically, for companies just to get stagnant, just to sort of stay with what seems to be working and sort of missing the boat. I also think that they really underestimated the sort of will and the operational vision of Walmart, which has just been so immense and has just gone in. And even in places where Kmart was well established, Walmart has just crushed them.
You're a guy with a big view. What does it mean that we lose attention Kmart shoppers and blue light specials? Is there a sociological imprint that's gone? Even in this recent war, authorities talked about the Kmart families being the families that provided soldiers for war. What store is going to provide soldiers, the young men and women now?
Well, I actually think Walmart is really that store. One of the interesting things about its fall recently was, for instance, that they tried to cut back very heavily on their spending on advertising, the circulars that you get in Sunday. Mm-hmm. And when they cut back on the spending, they found that their customers just disappeared because they had sort of hooked their customers on sales, where people just go to Walmart because they know that there are low prices. So it's hard to see what Kmart adds in a world where you already have Walmart, Target, and, you know, other kind of category killer stores.
Feels like history. Amazon.com is and was supposed to be the future. It's taken a long time to turn a profit, and even now it's only $5 million on $3 billion in net sales, and doubt that they're going to stay profitable in even the next quarter.
I mean, Amazon still has a long way to go, I think. And obviously, the sort of general down in the internet has kind of hurt Amazon. But I do think that its performance in the last quarter was very impressive. I think it was also something that a lot of people saw. Amazon has kind of cut back on its discounts. It's cut back on a lot of its special offers. It certainly has done a much better job in the past year of improving not just its service, but the way its warehouses actually function internally. And, you know, Amazon is a company that, unlike Kmart, I think has learned from Walmart. In fact, you know, famously, when was it, say, 3 or 4 years ago?
Raided their management.
Right, exactly. Raided Walmart for management and was sued for doing so. And I think that, you know, they have done a good job of incorporating those lessons. I also think, you know, the conventional wisdom about Amazon is to some extent right, which is they built a brand that customers are still loyal to. Now, you know, what that means in terms of Amazon stock, is something, you know, I think is a very complicated question.
What does it mean for the entire internet that Amazon finally eked into the black, Jim Surowiecki?
I think it's good news. I think, you know, if you think about eBay and Amazon and to some extent Yahoo, all of them had pretty good quarters. And I think, you know, the bellwether stocks are doing well. And I think that the idea that internet retailing is a reality is a good thing in general. But again, you know, the roadkill on the internet superhighway has been so immense that I think we're all a bit chastened.
Any bigger message for the economy? We see an old retailer cleared out of the retail undergrowth and Amazon finally poking through to profitability. Is there a big economic message here?
I think there's a big economic message. I do think that it's a good indication of sort of what, in general, capitalism is good at, you know, which is sort of getting rid of the old and bringing in the new. I mean, much more so than say, Enron, which, you know, Paul O'Neill has called the genius of capitalism. In terms of the broader economy, say, you know, are we in a what's happening to us in terms of the recession? I think it's very hard to draw any conclusions from it. One of the things that I actually was quite impressed by in terms of Kmart's fall is that no one is saying, you know, oh, it was all September 11th. I think people know this is because, you know, the company just was doomed.
James Surowiecki covers business for The New Yorker. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is not going to sugarcoat anything. He says what he's got to say. He doesn't apologize or kowtow to anyone. Since September 11th, his straight-talking, tell-it-like-it-is manner, mixed with a fair dose of wit and charisma, has him riding high. In fact, his press briefings have become daytime television high points among many Americans. But just a year ago, Americans weren't so sure about Rumsfeld. Before the war on terror, he seemed like a relic from the past. In the mid-70s, under President Gerald Ford, Rumsfeld served as the youngest ever Secretary of Defense. There he earned a reputation as an infighter, not afraid to take on the likes of Henry Kissinger and even President Ford himself. But 30 years later, his Cold War manners reappeared as dated. Then came September 11th, and Rumsfeld stepped up to the global war on terror with all the confidence and competence of a real leader. Now he's verging on American folk hero status. Who is Donald Rumsfeld? Is he history speaking, or is he the future? And what do you think of him? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Robert Wright joins us tonight from Princeton, New Jersey. He's a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Moral Animal and Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny. Good evening and welcome, Robert Wright.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor with the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Robert Wright, talk to us about the Donald Rumsfeld who has emerged since September 11th, and what is it about him that has got America so smitten?
Well, I think for starters, he represented the war effort, and America was very strongly behind the war effort. And, you know, he had a number of successes to report, which always makes a good impression.
Mm-hmm.
But I think beyond that, he has this kind of candor that is pretty rare in a politician, and I think a lot of Americans have been kind of yearning for it for some time. And he has a sense of humor. I just think you put all these ingredients together, and he became a very popular guy.
How does he pull off the thing that so few politicians in Washington pull off? That is, he speaks with candor, and yet it makes him more popular. It doesn't get him in trouble.
Well, actually, for a while, it did get him in trouble. Before September 11th, he was an unpopular guy in some parts of Washington, precisely because he had not exercised a lot of diplomacy in trying to get some changes made in Pentagon policy, and he had rubbed a number of people the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on the context. You know, throughout his career, I guess it's had varying effects depending on the context.
It's working. It's working right now, wouldn't you say? And why is that?
Well, again, I mean, people, I've long had a theory that if any politician came out and just made a habit of more or less telling the truth whenever he or she spoke,
how novel.
That person could immediately be elected president. I mean, our politicians have become so kind of enslaved to poll findings and so determined not to offend anyone when they speak that they've just acquired a kind of synthetic quality that I think Americans have long been sick of, and Rumsfeld, in part because he's not running for office. I mean, he's not an electoral politician to begin with, and also maybe because he's you know, reaching the end of his career in any event, isn't trying especially hard to please. And I've long thought that a politician that didn't try very hard to please the American people would probably please them more than a lot of the politicians who do.
So, Robert Wright, when Donald Rumsfeld tells it like it is, what is he telling the American people about the world? And what do you see he's conveying about his perspective on the world?
Well, this is what bothers me a little. I think, in a way, the very bluntness that he's shown on TV and the kind of lack of concern for public relations and how his opinion is going to play around the world, I think suggests that he doesn't entirely understand the dynamics of the larger war on terrorism that we face.
Also,
I'm not talking about the strictly military exercise in Afghanistan. I think clearly the Pentagon pretty much knew what it was doing in Afghanistan. But I think this larger question, the long-term question of how you reduce the terrorist threat in the future, I think if you're going to take a good stab at that problem, you have to appreciate that public relations, in a sense, matters in a way that it really didn't used to matter. And the reason for that is this, that as you have more and more relatively small groups of people who can wreak significant amounts of damage, and I think that technological evolution is creating that situation and will continue to, when you have that situation and when these people find their base in kind of popular hatred, in other words, the hatred of radical Muslims empowers terrorists. The hatred of large groups of radical Muslims empowers the terrorism. Then you have to start worrying about how America is perceived abroad.
So when Donald Rumsfeld speaks, what do you hear him saying that you think flies in the face of mindfulness of that public opinion?
Well, for example, the Pentagon dropped some leaflets that admittedly included a doctored photograph of Osama bin Laden.
This is where he's cleaned up to look like a Miami tourist.
Yeah, more or less. He was in Western dress. He didn't have a beard. The leaflet said, "This man has abandoned you." And the implication, you know, was that, he's off in Miami, smoking cigars. And a reporter asked Rumsfeld, "Now, wait a second, is it a good idea to be in the business of doctoring photographs? After all, we recently tried to convince the world that this videotape we had of Osama bin Laden admitting in a candid, an unguarded moment that he had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks. You know, we've been trying to convince the world that this was not a doctored videotape, that we don't do that kind of thing. And now we drop these leaflets that are obviously doctored. Is that a good idea?" And Rumsfeld kind of said, "Oh, look, it doesn't matter. You know, these people, they're going to lie about us. What can you do?" And I just think, you know, we have to show a little more concern than that for even the little things that we can do to convince as many Muslims around the world as possible that fundamentally we are on the side of right.
Jack Beatty, Donald Rumsfeld led a huge military machine to a kind of victory in Afghanistan. Is he really responsible to keep up with the details of how pictures of bin Laden are doctored?
Well, I don't know. He seems to keep up with every detail.
He does, doesn't
he? You get that impression in his omniscient briefings, excuse me. But I think that gives him credibility problems at the same time, since he seems to know about everything. When he denies things that just seem patently so, then it creates credibility problems. And one of them is about civilian casualties in this war, and another about the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo now. He just says, "No problem anywhere."
End of story. We're talking tonight about U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Is he your new hero? What do you think of the man? How would you define his appeal? And do you see him as the man of the future or man of the past? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. If you tune into CNN, he's there every day at the briefing room, at the podium in the Pentagon, giving the latest on what's happening in the war on terror, telling it like it is. And there's no doubt that in very large respect, this guy is a straight shooter. But is he telling the real story of where the world's headed? Do you see a hero or misplaced American imperiousness behind that great jut jaw? If Donald Rumsfeld is responsible for success so far in the war on terror, is there anything else to say? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Robert Wright. He's author of Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, and a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Robert Wright, you say that the question is whether Donald Rumsfeld sees the larger contours of the war on terror. What are you getting at there?
Well, I think he is a man who came of age when the basic threat to the United States was other nation states. And the good rule of thumb back then was that as long as every leader in the world either likes you or fears you, you're in pretty good shape, because it's only people who command armies that are going to be a problem for you. Now we're in a very different situation. And again, I think it's partly for technological reasons that are not going to go away. So we have to think about this as a continuing threat. And the situation is that non-governmental entities can cause large amounts of damage, and in theory, much larger amounts of damage than were caused on September 11th. So I think you've got to start thinking about these kind of non-governmental threats. And before September 11th, one of Rumsfeld's virtual obsessions was a missile defense system. And I think there are arguments pro and con for this that can't be easily dismissed. I don't think it's a trivially simple issue, but I think
certainly not.
The degree of emphasis he put on it suggested that he really didn't fully appreciate that we were much more likely to see a nuclear bomb exploded in the U.S. as a result of terrorists sneaking one in than we were to see a nation state launching a nuclear missile. And that was when I first started to worry that he really was not fundamentally in touch with the times. And in that way, it's kind of ironic that September 11th really kind of put wind in his sails. I mean, really radically raised his stature in Washington, because I just think what happened on September 11th was a long way from a vindication of his worldview.
And yet, it'd be easy to undersell, or I guess maybe not, how much the country wanted to see that, or at least a big part of it, wanted to see that large and in charge military figure inspiring confidence that the U.S. was going to go forward, that our military would somehow save us from what felt like an onslaught.
Sure. No, I think, you know, in a time of national crisis, and this was a genuine time of national crisis, a nation looks for a leader. Let's face it, President Bush doesn't have tremendous skills in impromptu speaking. I don't think he entirely filled that role himself. Rumsfeld filled the rest of that role. Doesn't always work that way. If you remember the Persian Gulf War, Dick Cheney, who was then Secretary of Defense, really didn't choose to put himself on TV. But Rumsfeld made the decision, and it certainly it worked in his favor, I think, in a political way, and it may well have been in the nation's interest to have a kind of rhetorical rallying point. It may have been good for the nation's spirit or something.
What a tricky moment. On the one hand, there's a fear factor that wants that man on horseback, and yet maybe that man on horseback is not the way of the future. He's got quite an unusual way of relating to the Washington press corps. And he, especially those that cover the Pentagon, he's become known for his quick wit in the press briefings. He's noted for not being afraid to tell a reporter that he or she's asked a bad question. Let's listen.
Why are you taking a trip overseas without knowing whether or not you're going to be received in countries in that region?
Well, first of all, you're beginning with an illogical premise and proceeding perfectly logically to an illogical conclusion, which is a dangerous thing to do.
Donald Rumsfeld talking with the press. Jack Beatty, this is a man who's not afraid to tell you what reality is.
Well, I think that's what Bob is questioning, though. I mean, what is his grasp on reality? As Bob pointed out in his piece in Sunday's Times, September 11th, you could say, really called into question his basic worldview, that the main security threat was a missile from a rogue state. And instead, this has empowered him and empowered the other people in the administration who are for missile defense. And they've just sort of seized on it and say, well, you know, that was I was talking about asymmetrical threats, and that's an asymmetrical threat. Well, the logic of that, and I think Bob does this beautifully, he says it's like the French minister who built the Maginot Line. He could have claimed the vindication after Hitler's troops invaded because, after all, he'd warned about the German threat. And so the question about his grasp on reality, and here we come to something I think about Rumsfeld that's central. He is a movement conservative. That's a descriptive term, not a negative term.
Define it.
Well, it means that for 30 years he has been part of the sort of defense establishment in the Republican Party, which has been sort of furnishing arguments to Republican politicians. And in particular, he has been part of the sort of war-fighting school of defense intellectual, people who aren't terribly afraid of they don't seem at all as much afraid of nuclear weapons as the rest of us would like them to be.
If it's war, so be it.
Yes, and they don't have a very clear idea of history. History showed that deterrence worked. And yet Rumsfeld says deterrence isn't going to work in the future against these rogue states. We need defense. And he just keeps asserting that. And yet here's the reality of 50 years of the peace kept by deterrence. And these movement conservatives regard deterrence as a kind of cowardly thing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we're cowed by the thought of somebody else's nuclear weapons. And this leads to a kind of it's in the latest Nuclear Posture Review that he put out, in which not only do they run down the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty that Tony Blair said was vital to the safety of the children of the world we bequeath to our children, not only that, but they actually talk about there of the development of mini nukes, that is, nukes that could blow up caves and so on. Well, this is breaching the barrier that Hiroshima set up, the taboo around the use of nuclear weapons. So he's, to me, a frightening figure for these reasons.
Robert Wright and Jack Beatty, a lot of callers are lined up to join our conversation. We want to welcome them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Is Donald Rumsfeld the man of the future or the past? If he's responsible for success so far in the war on terror, is there anything else to say? Susan's on the line. Welcome, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a very nice, good program. And
thanks.
This is the first time I've called into any program.
Oh, we're glad to have you. You've
so
breached the barrier.
I'm a little bit frightened. But what I started out by saying when I called, no one has polled me. No one has asked me where I stand on this. And I think that Rumsfeld is a very frightening person.
Why so?
Why? Because I think he's a liar. I think he comes from the Cold War. He has a perspective of as your guests have been saying, he has a perspective of being a Cold War perspective.
But why a liar? His reputation has become that of a straight shooter.
When I listen to him, I hear a liar.
In what regard? What's coming across as false?
When he talks about what we've done, we haven't lost anybody. We've lost people. We haven't killed everybody. We've killed lots of people. His take on Afghanistan, on what we've done in Afghanistan, isn't heroic. I mean, his take is heroic.
Yes, it is.
My take on it is not heroic.
Susan, you've made your first call, and we're glad to have it. We hope you'll call again. Robert Wright, you know that the poll numbers show that Americans are generally very favorably disposed toward Donald Rumsfeld. Here's Susan, a caller, saying he doesn't strike her that way at all. Where's the demographic line, do you think, that divides the Rumsfeld boosters for those who don't find him so appealing?
Well, I think it's
maybe intellectual line. I'm not sure what to describe it as.
I don't really know. I mean, I think in times of war, there's a very well-known rally-round-the-flag effect, and it certainly affects – I mean, presidents poll numbers automatically shoot up in time of national crisis. And I think the same goes for anybody who's associated with the leadership of a war. So I'm not sure how many people there even are on the other side of that line anymore. And I don't purport to be an expert on the demographics of it.
Well, and the military did look pretty competent, didn't it?
I think so. I think, and again, I have my own peeves. I frankly would have rather seen Bush not be quite so casualty averse. I don't know to what extent that was Bush's policy, Rumsfeld, whoever's, but the truth is, I think if we had been willing to risk more American lives, we could have done a number of things better, including possibly catch or kill Osama bin Laden, mm-hmm. possibly bring the thing to an end sooner, possibly kill hundreds of fewer civilians over there, and so on. But at the same time, look, there were a lot of people saying this was going to be a quagmire, and they, in that context, they cleaned the thing up pretty fast. But again, my complaint about Rumsfeld is not as a military strategist in the sense of conventional military wars. Mm-hmm. My concern is that he doesn't have a grasp on the larger foreign policy dynamics in the modern world and the real long-term threats to American security, and yet he has been elevated to a position of real influence over those kinds of issues within the administration.
An influence, you say, is only likely to grow now with the success in the field. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just have a very quick critique of I didn't get the names of the two experts.
Robert Wright is with us and our analyst Jack Beatty.
That's fine. I forget which one was kind of more critical of Rumsfeld, but I got his ideas more than his name, and that's the important part.
Mm-hmm.
There's an undercurrent that I'm hearing a lot in the media, especially on NPR, that really bothers me.
Tell us.
And I think there's this fear, underlying fear that that what we've all agreed to here is that I'm very progressive and very liberal,
okay.
but at this particular time with what happened, we need to just put up with the conservatives fighting a war for us, and we put up with that until that problem is solved, mm-hmm. and then we'll go back to being progressive again. And in fact, I think that's totally wrong. I think this is a progressive war. It's not a perfect war. It's not always done right. It's not always done progressively. But it's a war that absolutely has to be fought for progressive reasons.
Are you saying to unshackle the women of Afghanistan? How do you find the root of that progressivism in the war?
Well, the thing is, one thing I think is very destructive that I've heard on and off on not your show, but mm-hmm. in the media in general, is there's a voice out there that keeps popping up, and that voice is one of pacifistic perfectionism, and it's this idea that we can mm-hmm. be pacifists here and solve this problem and make the world. In fact, being a pacifist right now is supporting violence. And it's allowing violence to happen. And the last time things were like this were 50 years ago when the Nazis were rolling across Europe. To be a pacifist in the face of Hitler is actually violent because it's to allow extreme violence mm-hmm. to get the upper hand.
It's no perfect world out there. It's,
right. And the test of values is practical application. It is absolutely useless to be progressive if you don't know how to practically apply your values to the real world. And
John, hang on. I want to put that Robert Wright first and get your response. Robert Wright, what do you make of John's critique?
I actually haven't heard from any pacifists. I mean, I haven't heard a lot of people who are out and out opposed to the war, and I'm certainly not a pacifist.
Well, take the bigger point that this is a progressive war, John says, and he's glad to have Donald Rumsfeld out there fighting it.
Well, I think I don't know that I even would put an ideological stripe on it. It's just to attack Al Qaeda is just a legitimate war. It's just a justified war because we were attacked by them. In my own writing, I haven't opposed the war, but I've stressed that this is in a sense a different kind of war, precisely because of the long-term terrorist blowback, so that things like killing large numbers of civilians could come back to haunt us in a way that it wouldn't normally in a war. But I frankly have just not heard, even on NPR, a whole lot of out and out opposition to the war. If anything, I think there's been a sense that you have to be very careful about what you say in criticizing the war effort or in criticizing George
Bush. Well, we try to say whatever we believe and feel here. Jack Beatty, what's your view of John's critique? It's a progressive war, and by golly, let Donald Rumsfeld go fight it.
Well, I thought it was an original assessment, and it sort of took me aback. I had to think a minute. First of all, you know, the forces that he's fighting with, I think it's fair to say, are Bill Clinton's army. That's the army we heard was so, you know, we had a gap, it couldn't work, it was all, it wasn't up to the snuff and so on. Well, it proved to be. But to the larger point about the progressive character of the war. You know, when you're fighting fascism, and I think this is a kind of kind of fascism, that is progressive. What worries me, though, is what we've seen again and again here is our allies in the war have used this war to crack down internally on their own, not just terrorists, but even dissenters, even people who want to be into the get into the political life. And that is anti-progressive. That's just driving, you know, that's just making us the friends, uncritical friends of dictators and bullies and also people who, by the logic of these things, are creating future enemies for us. So there I fear the anti-progressive character of the war, frankly.
John, what do you make of that?
I think both points are really good, and I actually wanted to just leave with actually a criticism of Rumsfeld, if I can make a small one.
Sure, go for it.
Okay. I'm pretty supportive of him in general, and I like him personally. I like his personality. I disagree with him, however, in the fact that he actually is casualty averse, and that's part of why Osama bin Laden is still loose. I think that we actually should have been more aggressive in getting troops on the ground to stop him. And the biggest reason, well, you don't have to do a lot of research to find out there are a lot more serious weapons that bin Laden and his people would like to use in the United States. Some they have their hands on, some they don't.
We would all like to see that stopped. John, thank you very much for your call and your critique. So we're talking about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Robert Wright, you say that given the success in Afghanistan, Rumsfeld's role is only likely to grow his influence in Washington.
Well, that's the way things work. It's partly just a matter of human nature. I mean, when someone has a triumph in any context, there's just an aura of success, and people are willing to listen to what they have to say, even things that have nothing to do with the context of their initial success. I mean, this is one reason that, you know, athletes become politicians. We just think of them as winners, even though there's no kind of logical connection between being a good – well, there's little logical connection between being a good athlete and being a good politician. So, yeah, it's natural. And it's the reason that generals become presidents. I mean, there's just this aura of success. And sometimes
hey,
that works
a thought.
Out well. Sometimes it works out fine. I thought Eisenhower was a pretty decent president, all told, in retrospect.
And Rummy's not that old. Rummy for president? Can we see that? Hang on, Robert Wright. We've got a break coming up. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think of U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. Donald Rumsfeld is a Secretary of Defense who likes to give the impression that he's the one telling it like it is.
I am going to stay here and answer as many detainee questions as need to be answered. I don't know that I'll know the answers to all the questions, but if I don't, we'll find them. Because it seems to me it's time to tap down some of this hyperbole that we're finding.
Secretary.
That's our Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, tapping down the hyperbole. What do you think? If Donald Rumsfeld is responsible for success so far in the war on terror, is there anything else to say? What do you think of Donald Rumsfeld and his appeal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Gary is on the line. Welcome, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I have got a different approach to his appeal.
Okay.
My wife finds him sexy, and I'm not sure. I wonder whether other husbands out there have the same issue.
Well, Gary, has she articulated exactly what it is about the secretary that turns her on?
Well, she finds him physically attractive, which is a little bit disturbing.
Is it that big dimple in the chin? Is that the beginning?
Well, she's embarrassed to get on the phone, so she's listening, but she's embarrassed to get on the phone. But you know, so I think it's twofold. One is you know, she finds him attractive, and I think she says that he's a straight shooter, and she enjoys listening to him. And she's a progressive person, and here's a guy who is very conservative and I find dangerous, but she listens to him because she finds him sexy.
Gary, thank you for that enlightening view of Donald Rumsfeld. Jack Beatty, what about it? Gary's wife is letting her attraction, sexual attraction to Donald Rumsfeld, carry her away politically.
Oh, let this cup pass from me.
Well, but you know what? We are in a television age, and all these guys have become television personas, and they're on there with their big faces, and he's got that jut jaw and that massive dimple chin. Who can deny the rectitude of this man?
Yeah, you know, bluff certainty is attractive. I mean, in a world full of doubt, and we're all full of doubt and self-doubt, conflict and ambivalence, here's a guy who doesn't have an ambivalent moment in his life. His mind is just, you know, there's no shade in it. It's all, and that projects. That is what we think of as strength. But the whole question is whether this persona is also just a kind of denial mechanism, right? He's so bluffly certain because he's denying all kinds of things. He's not admitting them into that unshaded mind. So I can see where that's attractive, but I can also see where, when you think about it, it's a little frightening.
Well, surely the next chapter in this war on terror will tell in more nuance whether or not this approach is a winning strategy, or whether we've got to roll into a different approach that moves beyond the military. On that front, Robert Wright, what do you know about Donald Rumsfeld's famously ill-received reform aspirations and his once difficult relations with a lot of the generals around him?
Let me first of all say that I'm afraid, actually, that the next chapter may not tell us. About the success of administration strategy. What worries me about this is that wars have extremely long-run consequences. I mean, for example, apparently it was the troops that were left in Saudi Arabia after the Persian Gulf War that led to a virtual conversion experience on the part of Osama bin Laden and filled him with this rage that ultimately led to September 11. Now, who would have dreamed at the end of that war that it would have a consequence like that? So first of all, let me say that I'm worried about extremely long-run consequences in a way that I fear the administration is not. Now, as for Rumsfeld's larger
next act
aspirations, what's that?
And the next act.
Yeah, I would defer to Jack on this. If he wants to talk about it because I suspect he knows more about these kinds of issues.
Jack, are you there? Have you heard about what's happened to the reform plans? Are we seeing them in action? Do we have any sense of how Rumsfeld is getting along with his generals? He must be popular right now.
Well, one part of those reform plans actually could help, and it could help avoid the kind of Saudi troop deployment issue that Bob just mentioned, how that came back to haunt us. And that is, that defense review, he was talking about, let's have deployable forces rather than deployed forces.
That could get us out of Saudi Arabia, maybe.
Well, yeah. And it could get us out of other places, too. And there's a... You know, that was kind of fresh thinking, I think. And what he's sort of saying is, well, you know, technology is caught up sufficiently that you can have forces either here or on carriers or elsewhere and have prepositioned material elsewhere, but not necessarily your people. I thought that was kind of a forward-looking, and when I think about that, I see that as a kind of hopeful intersection with the war on terror.
And another mark that the war may propel that Rumsfeld view forward. Adam is on the line. Welcome, Adam. You're on the air.
Good evening. Hello, gentlemen. I'm enjoying listening to you a lot.
Good evening.
About two callers ago, I believe his name was John, he was more or less kind of pro-Rumsfeld and gave the impression of, you know, let's let the man do his job.
Yes, he did. Said he's leading a progressive war. Yes, he did.
I have to agree, and I also like what he said about being passive in the face of something like this can lead to violence. I normally would never be for an administration like the one we have now. I'm a union iron worker out of Local 7 in Boston, and I always vote Democratic. I always vote pro-labor. you know, this is not an administration I supported getting into the office at all.
But we hear you like Don Rumsfeld.
What'd you say?
But we hear that you like Don Rumsfeld. Is that where you're going?
Not that I like Don Rumsfeld, and I really don't care for him either way. I'm kind of unfazed by him. He's more like,
okay.
He's more just like a pawn in the whole thing, and more just a face with some words that he's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like his duty. But I think in a time like this, I think it's important that we kind of take everything with a grain of salt. You have to look at these people and what their jobs are and what their responsibilities are. I find him to be, in a position that's a tough one. He can't really,
No doubt.
There's not a whole lot he can give the American people. I mean, people expect so much of him, and they expect so much of the government, and they want to know what's going on with prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and all this other. There's a lot of really difficult issues going on. But unless you have the time and the money to get involved in politics, to change the vote, to do all these things, which I know I don't, especially with a small child and a wife and a dog and the whole nine. Unless you have the time to really, get political, you have to be somewhat supportive of these people. You have to sit back, I think, and say, listen, we're not gonna find a new new people to fill the positions until the next election. And I'm worried, especially as a pro labor person and living in a pro labor family. I don't want to see the Republicans come back into office.
Adam, our time is running down, but we got your basic point that you're glad out that Don Rumsfeld is out there doing his job and protecting the country. Robert Wright, there's got to be a lot of that sentiment out there right now. September 11th was a real shock. We've just got a few seconds, but don't you think so?
Absolutely, and I think that's largely responsible for the esteem in which Rumsfeld's held right now.
Robert Wright, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, your last thoughts.
Well, I thought Adam raised a good point there that, we in the press are forever putting these things under a microscope. And he's saying, look at the big picture here. We're threatened. They're the only government we got, and we have to support them. I just think there are different ways to support. And critical support is what, is another way of supporting. It's a way of saying, well, we're for you, but we want you to do better. And I think Adam might say, well, that's asking a heck of a lot given their situations. But I respect his point of view.
Who can help but respect it? And I have to say, agree or disagree, it has been refreshing, as Robert Wright said, to hear someone speaking straight, even if you don't agree with what he's saying from that podium in the Pentagon. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And thanks earlier to Robert Wright, author of Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny and the Moral Animal. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Yesterday, Peggy Lee, one of the most perennially popular singers of jazz and pop, died at age 81. Born Norma Dolores Eggstrom on the Great Plains of North Dakota, Peggy Lee went on to become a hugely successful singer, songwriter, and actress. She was the only woman to have top 10 hits in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and the only major female singer in the classic pop tradition to emerge as an important songwriter as well. Add to that the cool, breathy delivery that became a sound that would influence a generation of woman singers. The longtime jazz critic for The New Yorker, Whitney Balliot, once wrote of Lee, "She does not carry a tune, she elegantly follows it." To remember Peggy Lee, we spoke with Jan Shapiro, chair of the voice department at Berklee College of Music in Boston, who told us about what set Peggy Lee apart from other musicians of her day.
I've met so many who had fascinating ways, a fascinating gaze in their eyes.
What separated Peggy Lee from other singers is her keen rhythmic sense and her phrasing. I think that, to me, was one of her strongest assets that she had. The other thing that I thought was very impressive about Peggy Lee as she evolved in her career is that she, if anything, developed a very strong intensity about her work, her interpretation of the songs. There was a lot of emotion, although she didn't display a huge vocal range. Again, her phrasing and the interpretation of the song was very unique and strong, not maybe in the volume of her voice, but the strength of the emotion and the level of intensity of how she sang the lyrics was very effective. You can hear in the early recordings of Peggy Lee her, I believe, that she was probably influenced by listening to some singers like Billie Holiday and Mildred Bailey in the late 30s before she got her start. And you could hear that, the back phrasing and just the way she rhythmically alters a phrase.
You're sitting down wondering what it's all about. You ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right? Like some other men do. Get out of here and get me some money too.
There are a lot of songs that people associate Peggy Lee with, but I guess to me the one that is sort of the culmination is a song that she didn't write, but that there just seems to me that no one else can interpret the song. Is That All There Is?
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out of the pavement. And I stood there, shivering in my pajamas, and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, "Is that all there is to a fire?"
I think it just says it all in regards to not only her life, but how she interprets life itself and what she had been through or what we have all been through. She never had it easy growing up. Her mother died when she was very young, just as any professional singer during that time. And being a woman songwriter, it's not like she had it probably as easy as she would have liked to have had it. And also she had some physical ailments as she grew older that didn't always make it easy for her. So along with that and failed marriages, that when she could sing, she could truly sing from experience.
And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads.
I'm not sure that singers of today even know that much about how Peggy Lee's career made inroads for singers. And, of course, the famous lawsuits. Probably when she first did the Disney movie, she wasn't advised, like most musicians and singers, were not advised on what the best thing would be. And that she even decided years later to go ahead and say, "Hey, I not only want the credit, I should get paid for my work," was to me just proof of her savvy as a professional and saying, you know, it's not too late for me to let people know that I deserve to get paid for my work. And I think that there were probably a lot of other singers that did write songs, but Peggy Lee was actually able to get interest in her material and to record some of her songs or have other people record them.
Jan Shapiro is chair of the voice department at Berklee College of Music in Boston. Peggy Lee died yesterday. She was 81. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
I tag the bus and you tag the cab. When the bill of shears come, I don't see you.
This is WBUR.